Good afternoon. Thank you for your time. Okay, I'm Donna Cole. I'm a Reed's Fellow at the Yale School of Public Health. I'm also a visiting assistant professor of sociology at Simmons College in Boston. And I'm going to talk about some of the qualitative, some of the literature review and the qualitative research findings from my mixed method study on the use of alternative medicine among African Americans and some of the implications that this might have for ART adherence. So I just want to acknowledge I've had so much support and help. This study was funded by NIMH, but I have no financial relationships that have influenced the findings of this pilot study. I do want to acknowledge my mentors, Dr. Jean Schinsel and Dr. Barbara Guthrie, who have been very instrumental in the development and implementation of the study, and Dr. Guthrie has been of great assistance in terms of working on the paper. I want to call attention to my community advisory board. This was a community-based participatory research study, and I was fortunate enough to have four African-American women who are HIV positive, and they served as advisors for me, counselors. They assisted me in identifying venues where I could find people who would participate in the study. They assisted me with recruitment, even the questions that I asked, both for the qualitative as well as the instruments. You know, you do all the research and you get all your degrees and you're so smart and you go into the community and you ask a question and people say, "You said what?" So they really helped me in terms of, for example, if you go into the community and you ask an African-American woman, "Do you use alternative medicine?" She might say no. But if you say something like, "Well, tell me what people did in your family when you or someone else got sick," you're probably going to get a more accurate depiction of what actually happened in that family. And also Natalie and Salima, my research assistants, could not do a whole lot without them. So why should we examine plantation medicine? I think, especially in light of what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, I think we need to entertain the notion that we really don't have a lot of answers to our questions. African Americans continue to suffer from adverse health outcomes across disease states. So whether we're looking at chronic diseases like heart disease, stroke, or diabetes, or we're looking at infectious diseases like HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, hepatitis C, African Americans continue to suffer from adverse health outcomes. And so African Americans are also more vulnerable to AIDS-related mortality. We've lost over 550,000 people to AIDS since the pandemic began, and over half of them have been African American. So we're trying to make some improvements, right? So the Affordable Care Act does expand Medicaid coverage, making more people eligible to receive insurance. We're focusing more on cultural competence and patient-provider interaction. But our research shows us that just because we increase access doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to utilize healthcare services. And so I think it's important to look at the historical context. Maybe this can help to explain some of what we're seeing. And I think it's important when we're looking at plantation medicine that we understand that even though people were constrained, that even though there are structural constraints, there's also the persistence, a level of agency. People want to exact some level of control over their lives. I think specifically with regard to African Americans, those West African traditions are just so very important to examine. African people did not come to the United States without cultural beliefs in place. They were not a blank slate, so to speak. So this is a pretty important piece of film for my research. This is from 12 Years a Slave, which was the winner of the Academy Award for Best Picture. And for my purposes, I was very interested in what these women on either side of Patsy are putting on her back. So I don't know if you've seen it, but basically what happens is Patsy goes off the plantation to secure some soap for herself, which angers her plantation owner, and he beats her. So she has suffered severe lacerations to her neck and back. In Solomon Northrup's version of this tale in 12 Years a Slave, he describes Patsy as being literally flayed, meaning that the skin from her back is gone. And so what we're seeing here are, there's nine people. You can't see, there's a man sitting on the floor behind this woman. There's nine people in this shot. As you can see, none of them are white. There's a sense of collective devastation. You've got these men on the floor with their hands over their faces. Everyone is devastated, or as we call in mental health, but you know, there's some vicarious trauma going on there. And so slave healers depicted in this film were a very important part of the health care available not only to blacks on the plantation, but whites as well. So I'm assuming, based upon the work of Herbert Covey and some others, that maybe what they're doing is they're putting a solution on her back that consists of some type of it's water and maybe root or poke berries. Later they might have added lard and corn to create a poultice to put to help with the inflammation. Maybe when she was well enough to sit up, they gave her red oak tea to drink. So slave healers provided care in the absence of and in addition to Western medicine. So bringing West African traditions to the New World, African American slaves practiced the use of botanical as well as non-herbal treatments. West African health beliefs focus on the interconnection of the physical and the spiritual. The idea that health is linked to the relationships one has is based upon a West African health belief model. And so one of the ways that this would have been able to survive is because of segregation. So segregation after slavery and the continued segregation of neighborhoods would allow for many intergenerational messages on health to remain. So just as an example, in Boston is such a segregated city that you can literally tell what group of people have, you can tell what train has just passed based upon the group of people that are standing on the platform. So for example, if you go out there and you see white people, then you know that the Braintree train hasn't come. If there are black people on the platform, then that means that the Ashmont train has haven't come yet. In Hartford, Connecticut, where I'm from, it's predominantly the African Americans are segregated to the north end of Hartford. In Nevada, African Americans are segregated to the west end. And in 2005, after Hurricane Katrina hit, we saw that the majority of the people on our television screens were African American because they were segregated to the lower Ninth Ward. So some factors that we see in the research that have been listed as some key drivers of the epidemic among African Americans: neighborhood characteristics, your built environment where you live, your access to foods and vegetables, incarceration rates, crime. Your neighborhood characteristics are positively correlated to your health. Lack of access to care, not having access to providers. Provider trust is said in the literature that African Americans are less likely to trust their provider, that they're less likely to adhere to antiretroviral therapy. And there's also this really interesting idea that it's of interest to a lot of my students. They like this idea that, hey, you know, African Americans believe in conspiracy theories, and that they usually want to do their research paper for an HIV/AIDS class on that. That's really interesting to them. So that's something that has been listed as a key driver. So African Americans represent about 12% of the population, but account for 44% of new infections. In Connecticut, African Americans account for 9% of the population and about 44% of the infections. African Americans account for half of new AIDS cases. In Connecticut, we are seventh in the country in the number of people living with HIV/AIDS. The cities with the highest prevalence are Hartford, New Haven, Bridgeport, and Waterbury, and these are very segregated communities. Connecticut still faces issues in terms of the number of uninsured people. Testing is also an issue, and many people are unaware that they have HIV. There's also problems getting people into care and reducing AIDS-related mortality. So for this qualitative section of the study, we conducted interviews with 20 women. 10 of them were HIV positive, and 10 did not have an HIV diagnosis. We asked them about their overall well-being, their relationships with their provider. We asked them to talk about their access to care. We asked them about their ideas about AIDS conspiracy. ART adherence and the use of alternative medicine. For the women who did not have an HIV diagnosis, we asked them about their overall well-being, their relationship with their provider, their access to care, their use of alternative medicine, and their views on AIDS as conspiracy. All of the interviews were voice recorded and transcribed, and we used grounded theory coding. So we actually had to go through three IRBs for approval: Central Connecticut State University, where I was teaching at the time that I collected the data, Yale, and NIMH. We used purposive sampling and respondent-driven sampling. The sampling was based on the zip code, and we were very concerned about making sure that we looked at specific zip codes, especially the zip code with the highest prevalence of HIV/AIDS, which it, unfortunately, is the area where I grew up. I used the informed consent as a way of building rapport with the women. I spent a lot of time on the consent form, and I pushed Salima to do the same thing, that it was really important to us that they really understand what it was that we were asking, why we're interested in this. A lot of the women did not know that HIV/AIDS was so prevalent in Connecticut, or specifically Hartford. So neighborhood characteristics: the four cities with the highest rates of HIV in Connecticut are predominantly African American, and again, in the capital city of Hartford, the highest rates exist, with the zip code with the highest prevalence is in Hartford. Desegregation efforts have failed. I was in a desegregation program back in the 80s. Hartford continues to be predominantly black. It has an 85% unemployment rate, and the majority of the participants in my study stated that they were receiving state assistance, they were unemployed, or they were underemployed. Respondents overwhelmingly stated that on a daily basis they did not have contact with people who were not black. And so we know that, again, segregation leads to concentrated poverty, which leads to adverse health outcomes. So just some of the themes that came out of the research. One of them was that you could live without HIV medication. So there was a strong belief that you could survive an HIV diagnosis and that you did not have to take any kind of antiretroviral therapy. So three of the women were diagnosed with HIV in 1985 and 1986. One woman did not receive ART until 1999, the other two women in 1992. And so I asked the woman who was diagnosed in 1985, you know, first of all, why didn't you get into care? And she said she was in denial. But also she said she didn't have access. And so I don't believe we had AZT available until 91, 92. And so I said, well, how were you able to survive? And so she said, well, there was nothing else. So my family brought me oils and prayed for me. They burned incense and cooked for me, you know, told me to eat more fruits and vegetables, eat clean, drink water, tea. They would make teas and put it in the fridge for me to drink. These were herbal teas like ginger tea. She talked about chamomile tea. I said to her, what kind of oil? And so she said that she thinks, she's not sure, but she thinks it was olive oil that was taken to the pastor. And they would anoint her, lay hands on her, and pray for her. There was another participant who said that people can live without the medication that they give you. I know people that have been living with HIV for a long time, and they just don't get sick. If you think about it, if you don't get sick, then you're all right. So for the use of alternative medicine, what we found was that the HIV-positive participants, and again, this is just a very brief snapshot of what we got, they talked about using alternative medicine to treat side effects and also comorbidities. So they said that they use Epsom salt for bath or soaking feet for aches and pains, baking soda in the rectum for diarrhea. The one that really was interesting was the lady said she put lemon on the back of her head for a headache. I had never heard of that before. Have you heard of that? Lemon on the back of your head for a headache? I had never heard of that. A few of the women said that they smoked cannabis for pain and for stress. And they also talked about the importance of meditation, prayer. Now, one woman said that she had oil from her church and she would just use it to anoint herself. So she would just take the oil and just kind of, you know, anoint herself, her hands and her feet and her head. Participants with no HIV diagnosis talked about juicing fruits and vegetables, also holy oil for prayer, burning incense, sage, and frankincense. I'm Episcopalian, so we burn sage. It's supposed to clean out the bad feelings. They talked about using frankincense, boiling socks, and drinking the water for a cold. I've seen that in the slave narratives. So I was really interested in that. I was like, oh, okay, I've seen that. Flat ginger ale or ginger tea for stomach ache, and tea with a shot of rum. My dad was West Indian. He immigrated to the United States from the Caribbean, and he thought that if he were coming down with a cold or something, that if he washed his face with Ray and Nephew, the overproof rum, the 100% overproof rum, that would help to offset the symptoms of a cold. So that's also in the slave narratives, this idea that you can put a shot of rum or some type of liquor in tea and that will help you. Yeah, that'll do it. Then you don't have to go to the doctor and you can go to work. So this idea, I can take care of it myself. Is also based in a lack of access to care. I try to take care of things myself, but if I get real bad, then I go to the emergency room. That was very common. We found that a lot. Another woman said, every time I go to the doctor, I see a different doctor every time. I don't never see the same doctor. It's always a different one. So our measures of provider trust might be somewhat outdated if people aren't seeing the same provider every time. Many of the women with no HIV diagnosis did not have a primary care doctor, did not go to the doctor, and did not trust the doctor that treated them. And so we know that, for example, an untreated STI makes a woman more susceptible to contracting HIV if she's not in care. If she has a compromised immune system, she's not seeking care. This could be a problem in terms of making her more susceptible to contracting HIV. Provider trust. Jazz, I just couldn't stop laughing. She has so many jokes. She said, I go home and get on the internet after I go to the doctor. I go home and get on the internet just to check and verify that what they're telling me is true. Most of the respondents did not trust their provider. These are the HIV positive participants. And what was really surprising to me is that I thought if you're HIV positive and a cure becomes available, then you would take the cure. But most of them responded that they would not. And so I have Sarah, she said, they don't know enough about these drugs, and my viral loads are good, I'm managing okay, they give me something else, and then I get messed up, and then I'll die, and then I'll be pissed. So I said, you'll be pissed, and she says, wherever I am, I'll be pissed. That's a very West African concept, this idea that when you die, you go on to the next place. But she said she used the example of the interferon and the hepatitis C. And she said, you know, interferon, they thought that was going to be the cure, and it wasn't. Now it's something else. They don't know enough about these drugs, and if they came up with a cure, I wouldn't take it. And I found that to be consistent. ART adherence. One of our hypotheses was that people who used alternative medicine would probably be less likely to use ART. We did not find that. However, we did find that participants who reported depression had more skipped doses of ART. But for the most part, people took their medication. A key aspect of adherence is the pill burden. And we tend to think of pill burden in terms of HIV specifically, but these women had other co-infections, other comorbidities, and other illnesses, and so they were taking medication for a number of things in addition to being HIV positive. The HIV positive participants reported using alternative medicine to treat side effects and to assist with some of these other illnesses. So overall, Salima and I just kind of looked at each other and we said, wow, our sample is very sick. Regardless of whether they're HIV positive or negative. People had very high levels of stress. The HIV positive participants had comorbidities like hepatitis C, diabetes, heart disease. The HIV negative participants had upper respiratory infection, asthma, diabetes, and other chronic illness. Many of the participants reported having had a diagnosis for depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. However, no one was receiving any kind of mental health intervention, no kind of mental health treatment. Again, very high levels of stress. Some of the issues that they noted were having a child that was incarcerated, or they had a daughter whose the children's father was incarcerated, lack of independent adult children, so they're responsible for the care of the grandchildren, just a lot of stress. And so we know that people with compromised immune systems are more susceptible to contracting HIV, so I was concerned about that with regard to the people who are negative. HIV-AIDS conspiracy. Unfortunately, many participants did subscribe to the idea that HIV-AIDS was created in a lab. They reported that HIV-AIDS was a man-made virus designed to control the black population. And this was one of the areas where, when we were conducting the study, they wanted to ask me what I thought, and I had to really redirect them back to, I'm really interested in what you think about it. But this was unfortunate. This was one of the things that I found. However, I will say that this is race, but this is also social class, because in Charles Rosenberg's The Cholera Years, he talks about how the Irish immigrants, they didn't want to conform to the treatment plans for cholera. In 1885, there was a smallpox epidemic, and the French Canadians wouldn't take the vaccine because they thought that the British were trying to kill them. So it's race, but it's also social class. We tend to see that poor people historically are suspicious of conventional medicine. So some conclusions. We see that racial discrimination remains the root cause of poverty for African Americans. So we do have poverty among white populations, but their poverty is linked to geographic location. Lack of access to education or employment, it's not linked to their race. So black people are poor because they are black. Health is most affected by social class, and we know that poor people have less access to resources that prevent poor health, or as David Williams says, health-preserving resources. HIV affects society's most vulnerable populations. Certain populations are more susceptible to contracting illness based upon their social position in the society. And I think it's really important to understand the role of the historical context in shaping social conditions in producing disparities so that we can alleviate, mitigate, and disparities in health. Thank you for your time. I tried to get it all in there.
So it's interesting, you said segregation leads to concentrated poverty. Did you make any correlation between segregation and social cohesion and resilience?
No.
That may sound off the wall that I'm asking that question.
No.
That's not what we're talking about, but I'm just usually, you know, one is also looking at how something might affect social cohesion and how social cohesion in turn may affect health.
Okay, yeah, so social cohesion and social support. I guess I'm just concerned that, I don't know, I just want to make sure that the question isn't framed in the idea that people choose to live where they live.
Oh, I'm not.
Okay, I just was, yeah, I wasn't sure. Okay,
no.
Okay. So you accept that they're segregated to certain areas, but you're saying that.
No, I'm not saying
okay.
Self-segregate. Is that I'm saying it's self-segregation?
I wasn't sure. I just wanted to understand where you were coming from.
No,
okay.
Well, I'm merely coming from a sociological perspective.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying is that there's social support and social cohesion that can come from being in a segregated community.
I'm asking you.
Oh.
I'm not saying
Absolutely.
I'm just asking you because you made these links.
Yes.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is why other than, and I have to say something about the idea that it's the poor that are more suspicious of in the situation of HIV. Because I was working for the Department of Health of New York in the early 1980s, and there was definitely a conspiracy theory amongst the gay community, regardless of what their socioeconomic status was. So it might be more accurate to frame that in terms not of wealth and poverty, but in terms of power differential.
Or marginalization. Okay.
Yeah, or marginalization.
Yeah, absolutely.
But why do you think there was less compliance with ARVs in the populations you were looking at, other than, you know, the conspiracy theory? Were there other reasons for not taking the ARVs?
Right, the pill burden. For the women who had comorbid conditions, so they have pill burden in addition to HIV they've got to take. So one woman, for example, said she took 28 pills a day. Well, you might not take 28 pills every day. You know, you might not be adherent. So what I'm saying is in the literature, we're just talking about specifically HIV disease, and I think we need to really look at the fact, especially with the aging population, that these women are experiencing other illnesses in addition to HIV.
Question just about the IRB and any sort of lessons learned that you took away from that, because I've had that challenge as well. You know, was there anything that you really found really worked well to get through the IRB and also make the document understandable?
Yes.
And all that kind of
yes.
stuff?
Yes. They were very concerned about confidentiality.
Okay.
Very
okay.
concerned about that. And so Natalie was very helpful. She has a lot of Human Subjects Review Board experience, and so she kept saying, well, this is what we have to do to show them that the protected health information, no violations of the HIPAA Act are going to, that was really the focus. They were very concerned. And I actually had to meet with Central, with their board personally. I had to go and sit and meet with them, and that was the concern. How are you going to protect this information, given that HIV is such a stigmatized illness?